Colonel Buck, reel 9.
Was there any process of re-equipping of the regular men who were with you at Exeter before you were actually sent to France? What about uniforms, for example?
Uniform one?
What about uniforms, for example?
Yes, as I say, until a uniform arrived, the man was used his civilian clothes, and he was paid a little for it. But as the pay of a soldier was only a shilling a day, he wasn't paid much for that, I can show you. Because the regular soldier, pre-war, had a red uniform, which he used to go out in peacetime with a white buff belt, which had to be kept blankered. Well, all that had to be drawn from the regular soldier and stored. And there was nothing issued in return because they already had their two sets of uniform. But there was a certain amount, yes, of time before one got geared to getting the uniform that you could fit every man, and that you had a surplus in your stores. It was the same with ammunition, especially with the artillery. Sometimes they were, in 1914, they were allowed to fire 5 rounds a day.
Mm.
You see, because we hadn't the ammunition factories to do it. And you've got to remember one of those 18-pounders, as they were then, not 25, 18-pounders, they could get off about 12 rounds in a minute if they were really good. So you'd use a lot of ammunition when you had a 6-gun batteries in those days, not 4 as they have today.
When war broke out in August 14, do you recollect any sort of local reactions in Exeter where you were to the outbreak of the war? What I'm thinking of is that, in a sense, as regular soldiers, war was the sort of culmination in all your training, and I just wonder what kind of reaction the outbreak.
Well, the reaction of the public to the soldier was he became a favourite, and everything was pushed on him. They gave him cigarettes and that sort of thing. He became a national hero, the same as when he landed in France. It was terrible, the demonstrations of affection and patriotism, I suppose, of the French at first, of our soldiers, and they fed them and gave them wine and Lord knows what. But that sort of thing, when the war settled down and casualties started to grow, well, defeats were coming to us, the retreat from Mons and that sort of thing, things cooled off.
Before you actually went out to France, you were moved initially with the 3rd Battalion to Devonport.
That's right.
Yes. Well, what sort of activities were you engaged in at Devonport before you went?
Well, each regiment had a place which would be known as the, not the depot, but the posting for all returned soldiers, whether it was sickness or whatever it was. And our place was Devonport, North Raglan Barracks, Devonport. So that any soldiers who were trained came into the kitty down at Devonport. Any coming back from leave, or rather sickness, wounded, when their time was up, they reported to Devonport. And Devonport became the like a big depot to keep each battalion up, because we only had the 2 regular battalions, and the 3rd was known as the Special Reserve Battalion. Well, the 4th, 5th, 6th and 7th went off, they were sent off to India. Well, then you got Kitchener's army and the new armies coming up. Well, you had the, we finished with 26 battalions, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they fought in Salonika and Mesopotamia. The others were stationed in India. They were in Italy, they were in France. So this North Raglan had to supply all these troops when they wanted them. And you would get from the War Office, you will send 2 officers and 100 men to so-and-so, and then off they went.
Mm. Tell me about the process of moving with your battalion from Devonport to France.
Well, I didn't move with the battalion, you see. I was on the depot staff, and I moved to Plymouth. And Then, as a casualty occurred, I was suddenly called to go to France. Mm-hmm. I didn't start off with the 1st Battalion in France.
I see.
Right, I was posted to go to the 1st Battalion, but when I landed in France, the 2nd Sherwood Foresters had of the 8th Division had an awful beating, and they were very short of officers, and I was posted to them. So my first time, I still hadn't seen the 1st Devons. I was wounded with them at the end of December 14th of Trevor and returned to England.
Now, when you arrived in Le Havre in October 1914, how were you accommodated there?
In tents, from about 6 officers to a tent. Sometimes you might be lucky because a few had already gone up the line and yes. You could spread yourselves, but mostly it was 6 to a tent.
When you came to move up to the front, could you describe the journey for me? How the men you were with were moving?
Well, you marched down to Le Havre again and out to the station, and there would be a long, long train with 2 carriages, 3rd or 2nd class, and the remainder would be cattle trucks. And you put 40 men into the cattle trucks. There was a little hay in the bottom of them. And we had these carriages in which we were put 4 to 6 to a carriage. And there was no means of feeding the men except what they had with them, unless there was a stop, which were many, but unofficial ones. In which case the men used to rush up to the engine and bribe the driver to give them some hot water, which they'd make tea, and they'd come back with their canteen, you see. And that, it was a job trying to stop them. You couldn't stop them because these trains were terribly high, and if you got out yourself and the train started, it was difficult in getting in again. It was much easier to get into one of these trucks.
Did you know where you were going when
you
were trained?
No. Only the officer in charge of the party knew. And you suddenly got dumped at the station where they said all out. And there was the RTO there, the Railway Transport Officer. And sometimes there was a guide from your unit to march you to them, which might be another 10 miles away, it could be, or it could be within distance of the town where the train stopped. Occasionally, when you were going up, you didn't even reach your destination in the town or into Schelling. You had to disembark short of the station.
On this occasion, after you left the train, could you describe for me the sort of general scene as you gradually marched up, moving nearer and nearer to the front?
Well, you marched up. It wasn't nearer to the front, you marched up definitely to the transport lines. Now, the transport lines were where all the horses and your vehicles and your quartermaster was kept. And their job by day was to go back and fetch rations from the brigade dump. And then they would bring them back to the transport lines. And under the quartermaster's guidance and the 4 quartermaster sergeants, they would divide the rations for the four companies, and then they were put into sandbags, and then they were put on your own limbered wagons and went up as nearest to the front as they possibly could, which is nearly a dump well back, and your own parties came from the trenches to meet them. But you had to alter these things because the Germans, who always seemed to have higher ground than us, got to know where these dumping grounds were, you see. At the same time they were bringing out the rations, they bought up ammunition if you'd ask for it, trench stores, that's latrine buckets if you had them, wire, the stakes, shovels, picks, trench boards, all that kind of thing. And when you arrived at this place, you had a meal, and possibly it was too late to go up that day, so you stayed about that night, sleeping in a tent. And next evening, you went up with the rations.
As you moved up for the first time, what were your main impressions of what would have been a sort of new experience for you?
Well, I don't know. You couldn't see anything. It was very dark. When you got near the line, you stepped off the road into a communication trench where you went very slowly because the soldiers in front of you carrying a rifle and probably a coil of barbed wire and their water bottle and haversack and everything, they got stuck in the trenches and had to move or else a fellow fell, you see. And then you arrived at the battalion headquarters. Well, it was very dark. There was a candle in a small dugout, and Colonel said, greeted you. And you were then put to a company. A runner came and took you up to the company sector. Well, not much happened that night because the commander couldn't do anything, the OC company, but next day you were allotted a platoon. And he took you around to where you were and told you what your duties were. And then you carried on from there, seeing that the platoon sentries were posted. If it was a case of wet weather, that the whale oil was distributed and that they really did rub their feet with it, change their socks and that sort of thing.
During this period at the end of 1914, could we concentrate on what the routine of trench life was? And maybe you could do this for me by just taking me through a fairly typical 24 hours and telling me what the main features of it would be.
Right. Just before stand down from your night sentries, everybody was brought up to the alert positions, and otherwise those that were sleeping at their comrades' feet, at the sentries' feet, were woken up.
This would be about dawn, wouldn't it?
This is because that was the most likely time that an attack could come, you see, and then you were ready for it. When it really got light, then you stood down and the fellows started getting their breakfast, which was a hunk of bread and a piece of bully, and warming up some tea in their canteen. And some of them shaved. And then there was if you were standing in these trenches, which were half full of water and mud, like cream, then there was the long, terrible duty of seeing that each man changed his socks, was given a clean pair, and whale oil was rubbed in so as to prevent frostbite and that sort of thing. Well, that took most of the morning. In the meantime, you had your sentries posted.
What was the drill there?
Well, you simply, there were three men in a group. And a trench would probably be 10 yards long, and you'd have six men in that 10 yards, but you only had one up on duty, and then there was a traverse where it went round like that.
A diagonal.
Yes. That was to prevent a shell coming and blasting any amount of men. Well, in the next traverse, or in the next section, you had the same number of men. And that went on for your company, you see. And you went round, visited them. You had, if you got any report from battalion headquarters, which might affect your immediate front, you told the troops and the sentries about it and what to watch for. In many cases, we had to have periscopes because you were so close to the enemy. And in this case, we were actually between about 40 yards from him. And we had periscopes, which you put up. Well, you had to be fairly smart with those, because if the German had a chance, he'd shoot your periscope, and then your glass was gone. That sort of thing, you see. And then you put certain men to mend the breaches that had been caused by explosion of shells on your trenches. You had other men filling sandbags, which had been brought up the night before, and piling up to make the trench deeper, because one didn't want to dig down. The more one dug down, the more water you got. So you tried to make the parapet thick and higher that way by coming out of the water, you see.